Hi, my name is Tobias Haberkoll and this is Airlift from Berlin Review. Airlift is a new show from and around the magazine. We'll discuss pieces from Berlin Review. We'll have writers on the show. And what we really try to practice here is the slightly old-fashioned, but still useful, hopefully, craft of criticism. So we want to understand the world, culture and politics, fascism, imperialism, techno-feudalism, all the categories that really drive the news cycle by analyzing its somewhat slower and more contradictory manifestations. I could not do this alone, and I also wouldn't want to. So with me, I'm very happy, is my co-host Lauren Euler. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Lauren is a critic and novelist. She has some poetry published in our recent reader number 5 that you should check out. And so to start off, we'll speak about two movies that have both gathered 9 Oscar nominations for the upcoming weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So why should we even be talking about movies when World War III is upon us and everything is wrath and destruction around us?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a difficult question, and I have also asked myself that this week as I prepared to do the podcast. But it's also a question that in my adult life, people have been asking basically the entire time I have been working in the media. And, you know, how can we be talking about this thing when this other thing is happening? And like a cute answer is that both the war in Iran and the Oscars are competitions in which everyone who is participating is ultimately like a loser, mm-hmm. right? Everyone loses. And they're also evidence of the degraded, hobbling, manic, they're like manifestations of like the death throes of American hegemony and global power, right?
Yes.
Like I don't, it's hard to even imagine caring about who wins an Oscar to me, like at this point in my life, and also at this point in, you know, thinking about global cultural institutions, like American cinema to me is not like what it once was.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly our military industrial complex was probably never a good thing, but it's definitely not what it once was either, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever. And then, you know, maybe I don't know if you agree with this next point I'm about to make, but I think there is a very privileged understanding of what happens in war generally among people in the West and people in the media, people who have never experienced war, and not saying that I have experienced war, I have not, but people want to think that, like, in war, everything stops, you know, you're in war. And it's, you know, if you know anything about what's happening in Ukraine, say, or what's happening or what happened during World War II in Berlin or in London, life did go on as well as it could.
Yeah.
And you know, I think everyone in a war-torn country would prefer to be in our position, right? And I don't know that they would act that much differently if they were in the country that was doing the bombing, right? Instead, they would go on with their lives. They would go see movies, like,
yeah,
they would
yeah,
meet
yeah.
their friends, they would go to a party. And, like, you know, people just don't think about it, like, because they're so afraid of being in a war because they've never experienced it. But you would adapt and you could still watch movies, presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny you would say that that you don't care about the Oscars anymore, and that the film industry, you know, is not what it used to be, etc. I think, on the other hand, that this year had a lot of good movies, much better than the past.
But
couple of years.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about the movie industry and how the movie industry is sort of like removed from the algorithmic news cycle, et cetera, or reading what we have on our screens continuously, is that it takes so much time to make a movie. So
mm-hmm.
what we see now, obviously, can never respond to recent events. It's always with a lag of like at least 2 years. That you see things.
Right, but if it's a successful film, it stays, you know, right?
Yeah, so it introduces an interesting, like, anachronism almost in in our cultural consumption. So the two movies we're throwing together here.
Mm-hmm. That you're throwing together because you
agree.
I'll talk about anything. Yeah.
Two movies we're throwing together here. I mean, I somehow also wanted to talk about them because they both have caused a lot of debate among, you know, my friends, the editorial team. We ran a review of Sentimental Value somewhat belatedly because the film was already premiered last summer in Cannes, but it really had a big moment in January and February of Sentimental Value. We ran it yesterday, and it's a pan of the movie. So it's going to be Sentimental Value by Joachim Trier and Josh Safdie's Mardi Supreme, which I went to see in a packed movie theater at Corpus Tour.
Me too.
This weekend. Mm-hmm. I was placed in the first row on the extreme left, so I could barely see the screen. And I enjoyed it very much. And I thought it was very rich about the topics that you say. Mm-hmm. American imperialism. I don't know.
I think
aggressive forms of aggressive energy and hustling. Mm-hmm. The setup is it's the 1950s, so it's post-war America. We have the Jewish young man who is trying to make his way out of the Lower East Side and becoming world champion in a domain where the U.S. are total losers. Ping pong.
Is that really what it's about?
Well, that's.
I don't think that's what it's about.
But that's one frame about the movie I saw, how you can connect it to the present moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is taking place post-war, excuse me. And I think that this is very important because I think that there are a lot of tropes and ideas floating around about this time. Mm-hmm. In American history and in world history. And I think that actually this film subverts a lot of those tropes and understandings. And I think that it does it in a very exciting way because it's not a normal rags to riches story and it's not a normal sports film.
Yeah.
Right. And we go into this film having lots of preconceived notions about what kind of film it's going to be. And a lot of critics were, I think, fooled by that. Like, they didn't pay attention to the film, specifically my least favorite critic working today, which is The New Yorker's Richard Brody, who's always wrong in, like, a new and exciting way. And if you take the film as a kind of rags to riches, like, this guy's on the Lower East Side, he's scrappy, he's a hustler, like, he wants to just make it big. The U.S. is not taken seriously in table tennis, but we're going to beat him. That's not how it's framed, really. You just make that assumption because he's a Jewish guy from the Lower East Side. What is actually happening is he's almost going to be the manager of the shoe store, but he desperately wants to be the world champion table tennis player. He has already been to international competitions. He is already well known in the table tennis world, Mardi Supreme, mm-hmm. Little Mardi. Mm-hmm. He just needs to get money to go because it's in London. Like, he's always going to need money. It's a different class system than we're working with right now. You know what I mean? Like, he cannot just go. And also his family is like, stop doing this stuff. Like, you have to go work in the shoe store. Stop being annoying. You're really annoying. I mean, he's really annoying. He's not a hero. He is not the hero of this film. He is the bad guy of this film, right? And because it's focused on him, and because I think naturally we're conditioned when we're watching these American sports movies to, like, root for the main guy, we're, like, rooting for him, it's easy to miss that he's the bad guy. And also, if this were a normal sports movie, it would be focused on his kind of, like, struggles,
yeah,
his past, his traumas that have led him to become this kind of ruthless maniac who desperately wants to be the table tennis champion of the world. But actually, so the film begins in the shoe store, and then maybe 20 minutes in, he makes it to the competition. And when he gets to the competition in London, there's bad news, which is that the Japanese player has been allowed to come to the competition. Mm-hmm. And they say very explicitly, oh, but there is a travel ban. So, you know, there's some effects from World War II still going on. Yeah. And this Japanese player is really, really good. And
he's an actual
Intel
chat.
Yes, yes. But the thing is, you see him, because you're used to watching sports films like this, you see him as the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Marty is the antagonist. He should be the protagonist if this were a normal film, in which you find out by the end he has a disability. He's deaf, which leads him to be even better at table tennis because he only does it visually, right? Like, he only follows the ball. And he has endured kind of some kind of geopolitical, like, suffering, and now he's trying to represent Japan and get win Japan's pride back for Japan, right? And by the end of the film, there's everybody in Japan is rooting for this guy, because it's not just about this guy, right? It's about returning humbly but proudly to the world stage.
Yeah.
And Marty, again, because we have all these assumptions about post-World War Jews on the Lower East Side, you kind of forget, but even though he tells you very explicitly in the film that he's I grew up in America. I was born on the Lower East Side. I wasn't in Auschwitz. He's very cocky. He's an asshole. And he's I wasn't in Auschwitz, I wasn't in a camp. I don't really care. But he sometimes uses his Jewishness to kind of further his schemes, because he's always scheming. There's 1,800 schemes in this film, and he's always trying to go forward because he has one goal, and that's to be the table tennis champion of the world, right?
Yeah.
But there's no reason. It's pointless. It is just so that he can win, right?
Yeah.
And for his own reason, he doesn't want to represent America. It's not about America. He doesn't care about it. He doesn't care about the U.S. He doesn't care about his family. He just cares about dominating. And this, I think, is also very important, but I'll let you talk.
No, I think I agree with you. I mean, what's interesting about Chalamet then is that he doesn't have the attributes of the sort of dominant, hustling guy.
Mm. He's not an Italian.
He's a small guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's physically not very strong. He's punching above his weight constantly. So do you think a film like this, I don't know, would have been made, would have met the cultural moment 15 or 20 years ago, or even in the 1980s?
I have no idea. I mean, I think it's incredibly successful that he looks the way that he looks and that he is the way that he is. And also, I think, just from an aesthetic point of view, and also from an acting point of view, because he looks so awkward, and because of the way he plays table tennis in the film, there are many, many amazing scenes where he is straining at, he is coming out of his body. He's trying so hard. He is sweating profusely the entire time in the movie. And as in all Safdie films, he's just screaming. It's constantly screaming. They're always yelling. He's screaming and he's sweating and he is slamming that ping pong ball. And he is fully expanding across the entire screen, and he cannot be contained. Almost, he is contained, but part of the reason why he is so aggressive is that he's in this tiny space, right? The ping pong table is too small, right? And there's a scene early in the film where he's complaining that in tennis they get to wear white uniforms and they look really elegant and sophisticated, and they're not allowed to wear white and ping pong because the ball gets lost.
Yeah.
And so he comes up with a scheme to do orange balls so that they can wear white and be taken seriously. But there's also a sense of space, it's too small. It's too small in the tenement house. He's trapped in there. The ping pong table is too small. It's all this small stuff. And it's actually a really good subject for a Safdie film, because they're all about this pressure,
mm-hmm.
A relentless pressure that comes from the outside or whatever, and then everybody is trying to outrun or beat in some way.
Yeah.
And this, so I think this doesn't really answer, maybe I can make an answer to your question, which is to say that would it have met the cultural moment before? I don't know. But I do think that people, particularly in the United States, particularly because of the geopolitical situation that we're all living through, and also the political situation in the United States, feel a lot of pressure. Yeah. And it's not just about this, like, I need to, you know, there's no more ladder to climb.
Yeah.
So when I say, or when I get really agitated about the idea that this is just a normal rags to riches, like, hustler story.
Yeah.
It's not that, because not, that would not, I mean, that was a different cultural moment. You know, that moment is over. You cannot do that in the United States anymore. Maybe you can't do it anywhere. I don't know. But that is not, like, that's not where we're living. Like, that's not where we're living. We're living in this, like, I'm going to go fucking insane moment. And, like, you know.
So Marty, as you mentioned, we learn almost nothing or about nothing about his childhood. So he doesn't have a character development that that allows us to understand why he is the way he is. However, there are some scenes in the film about the Holocaust. One of his, the other ping pong player that he's playing against in London is a Jewish player from
Hungary, Bella.
From somewhere in Eastern Europe.
I assume it's Hungary.
Probably Hungary. An Auschwitz survivor. So Marty, in a way, is inhabited by that trauma that he hasn't lived personally, but that is still part of his story. And I think in that way, he's an interesting figure to look at from the point of view, from the vantage of contemporary culture.
Yeah.
We're all sort of like infused by horrible things, horrible pasts that we have or haven't lived. It's just the culture is so full of them. And it drives so much of personal ambition, cultural discussions. And I'd agree with you that the absence of sort of like a coherent life arc of the character purifies sort of like his hustler personality. And in that way, it relates a lot to contemporary internet culture, where, you know, it's all about hustling, getting rich, achieving success.
Yeah. And kind of the reasons, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Like the masculine, like this looks maxing, like tech world people.
Yeah. For example.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought about that, because I think you do kind of get him, he just doesn't care. He only cares about winning the ping pong tournament.
Yeah.
And there's something about that I think is really, like, provocative and brave of Josh Safdie to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important that he does not suggest that he has trauma. The trauma that he has, we see him experience. It's not off screen. It's not in a backstory. Mm-hmm. The trauma that he has is as I said, he goes to this tournament, and spoiler alert, he loses against this Japanese player, and he's devastated. And because of this, he can't, he doesn't get the prize money. And instead of going back to the shoe store on the Lower East Side, where he should really be working, because he could be the manager, because he's a very good shoe salesman, his family tells him, he joins the Harlem Globetrotters, this humiliating, like, band of, like, sporty performers. I don't really know how to describe this to a German audience. You're just going to have to Google it. And he says at the beginning of the film, I will never join the Harlem Globetrotters. I will not, like parade myself around, like, as a, you know, as a, like, a little performer who can do ping pong tricks and stuff with, like, an elephant or whatever. And then he does it, and he's humiliated.
And they're, for money.
Yeah, for the money. Yeah. And then he does, like, a couple of other things. There are a couple of other, like, scenes of true humiliation and emasculation that he experiences in the film. And this just makes him, like, more and more motivated.
Yeah.
Because he is kind of, like, I think of him as, like, a normal, like, asshole teenage 22-year-old guy, right? Like, who's just like, I don't care about that. And you see the scene of him talking to the elite table tennis kind of bankrollers or whatever. I don't know exactly what they are in the film. I'd have to watch it again. But, like, he's with all these rich guys, and he's trying to, like tell a yarn, like, in this old, like, trying to convince him to give him something. And he uses this friend of his, Bella, the Auschwitz survivor, and, like, gets him to kind of trot out his humiliating Auschwitz story so that Marty can take it and use it to get what he wants. And he doesn't, he's like, I don't care about that stuff. I don't care. You know, sometimes he'll say like, oh, I'm a Jew, like in order to get something, but that's all he cares about. Yeah. And I think like, you know, if this were a more liberal film, like there would be much more sensitivity to that. But I actually think it's incredibly critical of like the ways that the liberal media uses these narratives, yeah. Right? Like, I don't think it really matters that he has no trauma, because he does, like, by the end, you know, his relentless driving like kind of gets him nowhere, and he has kind of like there's a little bit of a catharsis, but I really like that there's no like, he's a bad guy. Like there's no, like you can't really relate to him. He's the bad one. Like that this I believe. So, and if you had any of this kind of trauma plot backstory where you're like, here's why he's doing, like if you had any indication of why he was doing what he was doing in this kind of very simple pat trauma plot narrative type of stuff, like it would be a total failure of a movie. It would be so easy.
The movie is very linear. It's also very fun. It's very upbeat.
Yeah.
It's sort of like visually extremely pleasant. It's suited, as a friend said, to people with ADHD, because things are happening all the time.
Yeah. Well, so it also doesn't, there's no time for you to worry about why is he doing that. You're just like, stop doing that. You know what I mean? Yeah. You're like, ah.
And Chalamet really is, he's also in real life, not a very modest person. So he can embody that figure very well. But let's now do something. I told you that I liked to compare things that have nothing in common, apparently. But I think there's a link between Marty Supreme and Sentimental Value. They're actually many ways to link these films, I think, but one is the main protagonists, the main actors, who are both nominated also for Best Actor. I'm talking about Renate Reinsfeh. And the way that Marty represents a sort of like typology of the modern contemporary character, Renate Reinsfeh does that as well, but a very different one. I mean, she is, let's set this up. The movie has been around for longer. It already won a prize in Cannes last summer and was in theaters since the fall, and now is nine times nominated for the Oscars. And the movie is about it's built around the figure of Nora, played by Renate Reinsfeh, who is a struggling actress.
She's not struggling. She's famous.
She's famous in the theater world, but
she's
struggling.
On TV.
She's struggling. She's doing a show. That's true, but she's struggling, like in a personal life. At least that's what we see of her.
She's suffering.
She's also struggling because she doesn't want to enter the scene. She has enormous stage anxiety in the beginning of the movie, and in the end, she ends up doing a film with her father that she didn't even like. So how do we get from this beginning where she doesn't want to enter the theater scene to that outcome?
Well, I think actually I wouldn't have said this until you made this comment about the lack of Marty Mauser's trauma. But actually, this is another example of a director treating generational trauma in a very interesting way. Mm-hmm. And I would say also, like, when I first saw this film in December, I guess, I'm kind of a fan of Joaquin Trier. Like, I have seen, like, almost all of his movies, except one, I think. But, like, it's not my sensibility. Like, I don't love them passionately. But they actually do benefit from like careful thought and maybe rewatching because they're structurally very interesting. And I think the big success of this film is that it represents on many different levels, like very many meta levels.
Yeah.
Like the structure of trauma. I hate to talk about trauma, but whatever, this is the life we leave. Like the structure of traumatic repetition.
Yeah.
And I think repetition is one of his major themes and definitely a structure that he uses in a lot of his films. His first film is called Reprise, and not for nothing. And I think that you know, you see Renata Ransva like freaking out at the beginning of this film. It's a really, really funny scene where she's in this kind of period dress and she's supposed to go on stage and she cannot do it. She's like, I cannot do it. And everyone's kind of drag her. Like there's like, everyone's trying to drag her out and push her onto the stage. And then her lover is like a producer or something. And, you know, he's like, he like slaps her and kisses her because she's like, please just hit me, like, you know, whatever. She asks him to have sex with her. So before he goes on, she goes on and he's like, we can't do it. You have to go on stage right now. It's really funny. But you see that she's really suffering and then somehow she does it anyway. And then the film could have gone in a kind of boring direction with all of the details that you learn about her life, which is like her mother has just died. Her father, who left them as children, like has come back and he's an alcoholic and she hates him and he wants her to be in his film. And she's like, fuck you, dad. Like, you never loved me, you know, whatever. You've never even seen me act. So why would you want me to be in this film? But it somehow doesn't like fall into those traps either. Like, even though it's a pretty standard generational trauma, family trauma film.
Yeah.
And it could seem like from the outside that it's quite boring. And I think maybe I would have thought it was quite boring, except for the fact that it's done in this very compelling, subtle way. That is structurally really interesting. And maybe you want to talk a little bit more before I just go on a rant about meta fiction and auto fiction, but I think it's actually really important to the way striking that he succeeds, right? Like, because if it was just straightforward, it was just like, oh, she's sad because her dad was an alcoholic and left them, and now he wants to come back in her life, and she doesn't want him back in her life, but everyone has to get together at the end, right? Like,
so
that,
yeah,
would be
so
tedious.
So Clara Miranda Scherfig, a film critic who writes for us, she panned the movie because she says something like, okay, it's beautifully produced and executed. Everything looks very, very good. The acting is very good. But the story and the structure that sets up the whole, you know, the whole script is extremely banal. Because it's, you know, this actress competing for the validation of her father, the aging film director played by Stellan Skarsgård, you know, who has many of the classic attributes of the patriarchy.
Bad dad,
absent father, has given, you know, has this sort of like genius aura around him, or pretends he has that. And Clara says that we have no indication in the movie itself that why is this guy even good? You know, why is he even... why is he considered a great artist when all we see of his movie productions is very, very, very cliche? So I think that reading, I mean, is fair if you look at models in the history of cinema that this film doesn't really want to follow. That's why
I
think. Well, I think the Joachim Trier, that's why I liked it. He's very happy with making a relatively conventional family movie. In terms of the aesthetics, in terms of the underlying conflicts. But what he does really, really well, and there I think I agree with you, is that he builds in sort of like loops in the film that make the conventional story about the absent father, the bad dad, etc., actually much, much, much more complex.
Yes, and also I think this idea that like the cinematography or the structure, the beautiful structure of the shots is not part of the film. Like, of course that, like, it's like, yeah, of course the cinematography is beautiful and the shots are beautiful and of course the actors are good, but what about the movie? Like, that's a lot of that's what the movie is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not just the content, right? It's also the form. But sorry, I interrupted you.
So I agree. And the thing that really struck me in A Sentimental Value is the quality of the acting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as we just said, I think that the trio of Renata, her sister, played by... Got to look her.
Enjoy.
Inga Ibsdotter Lilleas plays Agnes in the movie, and Stellan Skarsgård, the father. So this Norwegian trio, really, that this film
revolves around. He's Swedish, but yeah.
Yeah, but he, you know, even in the movie, he is right. In the movie, even he left Norway, went to Sweden like...
he's speaking Swedish in the movie, I believe.
Like Nausgaard, another,
yes,
another Nordic male. So anyways, these three, and also Elle Fanning's contribution, actually.
She's hilarious.
She's also very, very good at playing a bad actress in the movie.
Just a dumb American. I don't even know if she's supposed to be a bad actress. It's just that the American sensibility. I mean, part of the reason why this pairing of films, Marty Supreme and Sentimental Value, is so funny is because the sensibilities are so different,
right? That's what I want to get to.
It's just an American movie and a Norwegian movie.
That's what I want to get to. That's what I want to get to. But I still want to dwell a little bit on this, on Clara's criticism, because I really think that if you're not sensitive to the way, for example, that the sisters, the dynamics that's playing out between the two sisters. So one of them, as we, you know, spent time talking about, Renate Reinsve, Nora in the movie, is this actress, but she has a younger sister, who is a historian, and who is also much more settled. You know, she has the normal husband. She has a young son. She's the one really in the family setup that holds everything together. She's not in conflict with the father. She's accommodating the father in many ways, where Renata, the older sister, is going into conflict. She has done the actual work of doing archival research on, so her grandmother, Skansgård's, so the Gustav, the film director's mother, who we learn throughout the movie, committed suicide. And Gustav is going back into that movie, trying to sort of like working on that traumatic aspect of his own past. So we have the sister Agnes, who is doing all the therapy work, as it were, or the research work, to balance out,
I think, this
the tension between the actress elder sister,
the hysteric,
and her film director father. So, and I think the way that Inga Ipsdotter Lilias is playing that character is absolutely masterful.
Well, I think, first of all, what I was going to say is that this is another example of how this, like, you know, quite tired, like, topic could have been handled badly. But I think part of what I want to say about Trier's films in general is actually represented in the two sisters, because there's this scene which was in the trailer, so many people will recognize it, when Renata Reinsve is crying in bed and her sister, so Nora's crying and Agnes, you know, is there consoling her because she's really worried about her. You mentioned the suicide. I think I should just establish like a plot point here, which is that Stellan Skarsgård's character, Gustav is trying to make a film about a woman killing herself in the family home, which is based on his mother, and he wants his daughter Nora to play his mother. She won't do it anyway, but everyone's worried because Nora's also mentally unstable. She has all these episodes. She's had a depressive episode. This is referred to, blah, 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 blah. All of this is to say the reason why she's being comforted by her sister Agnes is Agnes is worried about her, and she has good reason to be worried about her because there is this family history of suicide, and also she herself has like, I think she's tried maybe once. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. So in the scene, they're in the bed. She's comforting her. This is very important because Nora says, why didn't you end up as fucked up as me?
Yeah.
And Agnes says, because I had you. And this theme that Trier has throughout all of his films, and you can see from film to film almost, which I will get to, is repetition, right? With different, like, we're not talking about Deleuze. I don't want to talk about philosophy. He is a philosophy guy himself. So we can be confident that he is thinking about these themes as well. But like, it is repetition with change, right?
Yeah. As the most central scene that actually we see twice, because Elle Fanning who is this American actress who gets hired by Gustav after his own daughter turned down the main role in this film that he's trying to make. So Elle Fanning is coming to Oslo, trying to speak English with a Norwegian accent and playing this family movie, realizing that you can't do it. And the scene where you really see that that this just doesn't work is when she has to speak, you know, that one scene where she says that she wants to throw herself on the ground and cry.
Yeah.
And she does it with, you know, the conventional pathos of, I would say, an American actress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a couple scenes later, and this is really where she realizes, or where I at least as a viewer realize, okay, she's never going to be able to do that movie. And then a couple scenes later, as you said, Agnes reads the script and brings it to Nora and asks her to read out just that one monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And Nora does it in this sort of like emotionally very, very different, somewhat cooler, but much more compelling way.
Yeah. Well, I listened to some interviews with them and they said that, you know, she didn't know that she was going to cry at some points, right? And then she just did.
Mm-hmm.
Which is always good for an actress, I would assume. But also, I think the scene of repetition, I mean, there's so much repetition in this movie, if you pay attention. There's just tons and tons of it. When she's, this thing that we talked about at the beginning, when she runs away, she literally runs away. She tries to flee the theater.
Yeah.
She also tries to flee her father, who wants to give her this script. Like, it's the same thing. She literally, like, runs away because she does not want to act. But the repetition that I wanted to talk about is this final scene that he wants to shoot of the suicide, of the hanging. Because it's in this house, this very beautiful house. The house is a character in this kind of stupid way. The house is what the New Yorker film critic Justin Chang called a repository of themes. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, that's how people use houses. So you get this, Stellan Skarsgård, when he's acting as Gustav the director, he says to Elle Fanning, he describes how he wants to shoot the scene. And he says, I want it to be a single take. And she's like, oh, a single take. And he's like, yes, the camera's going to follow her around the house. And then she's going to go in this room. She's going to stand on the stool and she's going to shut the door. And it's going to happen. Now, this is very important to me, at least, because I don't know why. So he's describing the scene. And then at the end of the film, they shoot the scene with Renata Reinsva, mm-hmm. with Nora. She's doing it. And it is basically how he describes it. This scene is the final scene in my favorite of his movies, Oslo, August 31st.
Mm.
It is exactly what happens. The camera follows the protagonist, who is Anders Danielsen Lee, who's also in this film, who is a heroin addict who's out for one day from rehab. And he goes into his family home, which is the same house as in this film.
Yeah.
You see at the outside at the end. Or at least it's suggested that it's the same house. It's the same house, like as in the same house in Norway that is the setting. And he goes into the house and he plays the piano and then he prepares some heroin and he walks through the hallway, his family's old house, goes into the bedroom, and instead of shutting the door is open and you see him overdose and die. And he's now, Trier is now like taking that same thing and like changing it and like making it better. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's incredibly powerful, I think, as like a statement about like being an artist.
Yeah.
That he is willing to do this.
Mm.
And like, I found the scene in Oslo, August 31st, is incredibly powerful and affecting. It's like really, really devastating.
Yeah.
And so I remembered it when I saw this and I'm like, oh, this is very important. And that's also why I say the cinematography, the beauty of the shots, right? The framing of these scenes is not nothing. Like, it's actually incredibly important to, like, appreciating what he's doing as an artist.
I have another thing to say about this final scene, but the way I want to get to is talk about the father a little bit more, so Gustav, and also going back to Marty. I think it's an interesting constellation of two films, also because we see in the figure of Marty Supreme and in the figure of Gustav, two problematic types of masculinity that are gaining, that are sort of like portrayed here. I don't know what you think about it. I'm really, really curious to hear you out on that in a way that you can still sympathize with them. I mean, you said about Marty Supreme, he's clearly the bad guy.
Yeah, but you don't even realize
But I think that what the movie really does is that even though he's an asshole and he's tricking everyone and cheating and you can still sort of like be on the drive with him and like follow him and then maybe not identify, but just relate in a positive way to him. It's like he doesn't get fully condemned.
Well, I think
the movie doesn't even want to make a moral point about him. The movie just wants to show his hustle.
Yeah.
And in a somewhat comparable way, I don't think that Trier, with sentimental value, is in any way trying to judge Gustav the father. Even though he did a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah, no, he's not.
Even though it's sort of like there's a redemption of Gustav that is allowed as the absolutely caricatural, you know, old white male in the movie.
Yeah, of course. And also I think that's like a sign that the movies are good, that there's not like they're not telling you to think something about these characters or about any characters, right? Like, you are welcome to think things. Like, when I say he's a bad guy, I'm not like, I can't believe they made a movie like this, like about a bad guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm like, that is how it is. That's how it is. He's a bad guy. Like, he's really bad. And I think the devastation that he causes in his life, like, is all the more like hard hitting, like, as a viewer, because it doesn't tell you to feel that, right? Like, you're allowed to feel it yourself, and you're allowed to feel this kind of like, there's the scene at the very end when he beats, his name's Endo, Enzo? Mm-hmm. Enzo, mm-hmm. Right? The Japanese player that he's been trying to beat. He beats him in this kind of fake, like carnivalesque contest that is not the real tournament, but he still beats him. And he's just falls on the ground crying and is sweating, and everybody else in the crowd is like disappointed because he wants it so badly that everyone's like, just let him do it. You know what I mean? Just give it to him. Like, he wants it so badly. Like, just let him have this fake prize. Right. And it's a very complicated, like, great moment of, like, it's not cathartic in mm-hmm. this. He maybe feels cathartic, like, whatever, but we don't feel cathartic. We feel sick, right? Because this is not, it's not an earned moral victory, let's say, mm-hmm. right? It's like, wow, he has a ruthless will to dominance that he will, like it, that we don't, you know, whatever, that's not our thing. Like, it's just table tennis, you know what I mean? And
let's go back to
but the masculinity thing. I think like that is a critique of a type of masculinity that in the past would have been just celebrated, right? Like, it's like, oh, he really wants to win, and the reason why we can relate to him is because, like, of course everyone wants things really badly. That's why we follow him. That's why we like him as a protagonist, because we're like, I mean, this is a very classic like narrative like thing, which is like, what does the character want?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Stellan Skarsgård, Gustav. It's a different story. I think it shows that, like, the progression that thoughts on masculinity and feminism have had over the last 15 years.
But let's look at the bringing in also, like, the character that you mentioned. The name of the actor, I have to look him up, is Anders Danielsen Lee, I think is.
Hottie, hot, hot guy.
He's
so hot.
he's the theater producer who's.
Yeah, he's like the stage.
He has an affair with Nora. Mm-hmm. He's married. Mm-hmm. So you would think he's very hot.
Oh, he's been hot, dude.
He's by the way, also
he's
a character.
A doctor.
He's another. He's
a doctor.
He's,
in
he's
real
playing.
Life.
He's playing in Worst Person in the World, another movie, the first movie, I think, that Trier made with Renate Reinsberg.
No, she's in this movie that I mentioned in Oslo, August 31st. She has one line, which is, let's go to the party.
Oh my God, but she must be extremely young then. This movie is so old, no?
Yeah, you're not. I know. In Norway, you're not allowed to act when you unless you're 25.
Anyways, so Anders Danielsen Lee, this I also find very interesting. In Sentimental Value, there are actually three male characters. It's the young boy, the nephew, mm-hmm. Nora, whom she's reading goodnight stories to, mm-hmm. and he makes like a big declaration that he wants, later on, he wants to marry her, and mm-hmm. she's so moved by it. actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. It's kind of sad.
Yes, yeah. Then there's his name's in the movie is Jacob, the theater producer who has an affair with her.
Mm-hmm.
She wants him to beat him in the face, as you said.
No, she just asks him to slap her because she's having a hysteric fit and she needs to calm down. And he does do it, and then
Then we see them in bed together on a different morning, and Nora, and there's this one scene where he speaks about breaking up with his wife or having trouble like at home, and Nora thinks, okay, he's finally going to leave his wife and he's gonna be with me, but that's not what he's doing. So he lets her down, even though in his sort of like demeanor and energy, he's very much the soft Nordic.
He seems like he like they have a
feminist
he seems
guy,
to like her. Yeah, he seems
very
to, they have
different
a very
from
sweet,
the father. You know.
Well, also, I mean, he says to her in bed, and this I'll just point out just to drive home into the ground my point about repetition. The scene in the bed with the two of them, where he says, "This is also in the trailer, so you may know it." You know, he's like, "How fucked up are you?" And she's like, 80% fucked up," or whatever. Then this is repeated when her sister is with her, and she's like, "Why aren't you so like?" You know, it's the same. It's the shots are the same. Like there's two people in bed, like Renata is kind of like talking about being fucked up. Anyway, what was the question? Now I was just,
well,
I was too
is,
focused
no,
on making
no, no,
I was just being like
that,
Marty Supreme, my American
that,
nature.
The thing is that Tria presents us with these three generations. There's actually another guy who is the husband of Agnes, whom she's making jokes about his screen time and stuff.
He's also
so
hot.
We have like the millennial husband, the millennial affair, the boomer father, and the very, very young nephew guy.
Uh-huh.
And I think what the film does is that you could think that, you know, Jacob is a sort of like a counter model, the feminist Nordic man that stands out against the old patriarchic ways of Gustav. But in fact, he's just a loser and a coward also. He lets her down.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I don't think he leads her on. Like, what? Like, someone who's leaving their wife should then go out with her? Why? Like,
no, I think she.
I don't think that that's
true. I think she was hoping. I think she was.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's a loser and a coward. It just means he's like, I don't want to go out with this. This woman's too crazy to go out with. You know what I mean? I don't think that that's true. I think that it's more. I thought of this scene where he rejects her.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "I'm leaving my wife," but no, this can't happen anymore. I just thought of it as, like, she has to go through the cycle on her own. And when I say flippantly, like, she's too crazy to go out with, like, that's, I'm thinking, like, that's probably what that character is thinking. Like, he's like, I don't want to go out with this woman. What I mean is that she can't escape the, like, whatever she has to face with her acting career and with her father. Like, there's no kind of happy ending there for her where, like, she gets the guy that she wants, the hot, hot guy who should call me. She has to eventually face, like, her father, her actual father, not, like, some boyfriend, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I think of the little child, the kid, the nephew. He is kind of repeating his mother's cycle, but differently, which is to say his mother, when she was a child, Agnes, when she was a child, was
played
in
the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, played in the movie. And then he wants him to be in the movie. And then he ends up in the movie. And so it's the same kind of thing. But it's kind of interesting because it is not usually like when we talk about therapy stuff, right? It's not a bad cycle, right? Like, it's not like, oh, I'm just repeating a cycle. It could be a bad cycle, but it's actually just a fact of life. That these things, you take these things with you and then you kind of change them a little bit.
Yeah.
That's why it's kind of a very realistic, like, a lot of people talk about Trier as, like, finally representing, like, real Norwegian. Like, this is what life is really like, right? It's not, like, beholden to silly narratives or tropes or whatever. Like, it's like, this is really what it's like. Actually, there's a profile of him in The New Yorker in which his friend, Knausgaard, talks about this and about how like refreshing it was when he found his films, because he was like, finally someone is like saying honestly, yeah, of course you're like repeating things all the time, but it doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be totally devastating,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You can't escape, right, that cycle or whatever. You can only adjust.
Yeah. So you've seen almost all of Trier's movies. I watched after seeing Sentimental Value, I went back and saw the previous one he made, which is called The Worst Person in the World.
Mm-hmm.
And both these movies strike me. I mean, I want to get back to this slight idea of anachronism,
mm-hmm.
With regard to, you know, the news cycle and the immediate issues that we're facing. And what I find interesting in Trier is that his films remind me a little bit of French movies from the 1980s. It is a sort of like, and that's why Norway or the Nordics or whatever are also so interesting as a almost utopian space. It is a cultural sphere where Nora, in this film here, and even more so in The Worst Person in the World, what she does is she's trying to become, I don't know, an adult person, or mm-hmm. she's trying to be someone going through struggles. There's not
really... She's like
really,
a Romare character, yeah.
Exactly. There's not really some major objective problem
mm-hmm.
that faces her. She's working in a cultural milieu. Everyone's well off. They have a big family home in The Worst Person in the World, which I somehow conflate now with the two movies.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing like a bunch of reading. Jacob, the other character that you like so much, is her boyfriend in that other movie,
yeah.
And also like sort of like struggling male artist type. He's a writer.
Isn't he like a graphic novelist or something?
He's a graphic novelist.
Yeah.
So I found it really touching and relaxing, actually, to go into that world where, you know, it's still the 2000s or 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
They are throwing nice house parties. It's open house. Everyone can walk in. It's a nice summer night in Oslo. So, I mean, there's a lot of darker stuff in it's Sentimental pretty, Value.
It's,
yes,
they're both pretty dark
but
films,
still,
actually.
But still, I'm not aware of like great many other examples of sort of like classical psychological drama with this kind of character development that have been done in recent years. And I think it's not a coincidence that this work comes out of Scandinavia,
comfortable, privileged society.
Well, yes, yeah. yes. That's
they
what
have
I'm
time
say.
To think about family dynamics. Because
maybe,
they,
yeah.
I think that's true. And there's the first of all, he considered like he's very influenced by like all French cinema. So his first film, if you're interested in him, Reprise, is a very French New Wave film.
Yeah.
It's a really fun, like lighthearted young person's debut film, and then is the second movie that I've been talking so much about. Oslo, August 31st, is a remake of The Fire Within by Louis Malle.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does take this influence, but does make it very Scandinavian. And the thing about the Scandinavians that I like so much and that we were talking about before we started recording is that they're all crazy. Like they have madness.
Mm-hmm.
There's like this is understood about the Nordic countries that they suffer deeply. They have a lot of demons. But like the structure of their society and the structure of much of their work, which I like so much, is that it's very controlled. It's very like egalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like, this is the way that it is. We have these things taken care of.
Yeah.
And you can see in Trier's films, you can see this in Knausgård, you can see this in some Swedish, you see this in a lot of Swedish novels, you see this in a lot of Swedish films. Of course, Bergman also represents madness, but they do this in a very like structural, formally stable way. And that way you can really see, it allows you to really see like madness separate from, you know, I think in an American film or even like a German film, you see, you know, when you have insanity or mental illness like represented, there's always some kind of structural, as in society, yeah. element that is contributing, right? Like you see this a lot in German cinema and in American cinema as well. But there's no like there's no problem in Norwegian society in Scandinavia, really. Like, well, sorry, don't get mad at me, but like compared to the rest of the world, they have no problems. And so like there's no pre-existing like structure for understanding your madness, except like kind of.
I think another
it's like back
thing,
to basics. Actually, another, crazy people.
Interestingly, another relatively small country, even though I think it's population-wise almost as big as Germany, that does a lot of great movies is Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And but about what I think where the parallel is between, for example, Norway and Korea is that it's societies in which the social rules are relatively clear and fixed, and then you can confront them.
But would you consider this? Would you consider Germany as a society in which the social rules are fixed?
I think Germany is much more in motion. Germany is much more. There's much more. I think the social change affecting German society in the past 30 years. So the frame of reference that you want to build these classical narratives of personal development against is somehow unclear.
Right.
And that makes it harder to do these classic
like character studies, as you say. Yeah. And it's like basically, because they're like, there was this New Yorker profile that I mentioned of Trier, and they talk about Oslo, August 31st. I'm sorry, I keep talking about this film. They talk about it, and they talk about Anders Danielsson Lee's character, and the writer says something ridiculous, like it's not clear why he can't get his life together because he's incredibly good looking, he has a family that cares about him, he has a lot of friends, he's well educated, he can play the piano, like what's his problem? And like that's the point, like you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's the point of the film, and if it were so easy to figure it out, like I do think that kind of the social conditions. We in American culture, certainly, and I would say in Anglophone criticism in general, people tend to do this kind of vulgar identity politics, vulgar Marxist critique where everything is, every part of a work of art is caused by some social problem. And if you saw, and the work of art is about feminism or women's rights or whatever. And so therefore all the problems can be solved if only women had rights, if only he wasn't poor, if only the government were doing this and this and this. But that's actually just not true. Like it doesn't happen. Like I think it's a disservice to people and to art works of art to read only through these lenses of like social critique, because as we see, it's not as if these people have any, they're like, they don't have any quote real problems, and yet they have problems. Right.
Yeah. Okay, Lauren, let's get the algorithm working.
Mm-hmm.
If you liked Sentimental Value or you disliked it, what else should you read or view?
Well, this is an easy layup here, which is that Joachim Trier's films, he has an Oslo trilogy, and there is another Oslo trilogy by another Norwegian director named Dag Johan Haugerud. Can I get an assist? Haugerud? I think. Anyway, Dag, we'll call him, we're on a first name basis, Dag and I. He also did an Oslo trilogy that was pretty big at Berlinale. And the three films are called Love, Dreams, and Sex.
Okay.
And they are also what I would like to call European talking films. Like it's people sitting around having interesting conversations. And these are interspersed with quite cool shots of Oslo. And my favorite is Sex. I think it's really wonderful. And that's all I can say.
Great.
Yeah.
I'd like to recommend a movie. A hustling movie. I mean, we were speaking about the French movie tradition a lot.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very atypical French film. It's like the furthest apart from Eric Rohmer that you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film by Louise Courvoisier. It's called Holy Cow.
It's basically the story of a young guy who tries to, much as Marty tries to become a ping pong player, the best in the world, this guy tries to make the best Comté cheese of France.
That's really funny.
It's really nice. So it's set in like the Jura region in the close to Switzerland, where the Comté cheese is from. Mm-hmm. And they have these cheese competitions, extremely regulated as these things in France are. You know, you have to be certified. Your farm, the cows have to eat a certain type of grass to give a certain type of milk. Yeah. And then you can like pretend to participate in the Comté contest. And this young guy, who is also driving motocross and is participating in these competitions, suddenly tries to take over the farm of his dad and make the best Comté in the regional competition. It's a really cool movie.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so thank you, Lauren, and see you next time.
Bye.
That was the very first episode of Airlift, our new show from Berlin Review. More criticism and conversations are coming soon. To keep up to date, please follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you give us a 5-star review, it always helps more people to find out about our work. Berlin Review is an independent magazine. You can read all our recent essays and back catalog of stories at blnreview.de. Subscriptions start at just €5 a month at blnreview.de/subscribe. This episode was produced in the studio of Jacobin Germany. Our audio producer is Caitlin Roberts. And my name is Tobias Haberkorn, editor of Berlin Review. Thanks for listening.